Good evening, little masters, and welcome to episode 216 of the Prancing Pony Podcast, where you can enter now at any rate if you want to, but it is not a very cheerful sight.
Oh, that's just because our guests haven't arrived yet.
Ah, yes.
But folks, go ahead and pull up a bench in the common room. I'm Sean Marchese, the real-life Lord of the Mark, and I'm here with the Man of the West, who knows well the empty countries that lie between Rohan and the Shire, Alan Sisto.
Indeed I do. Thank you, Sean. I'd still like to know, though, how Saruman got his hands on all this pipeweed, small matter though it may seem.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't we all?
Yeah. Folks, today we're going to be welcoming a few of our patrons to join us for, stunningly, our 15th quarterly Questions After Nightfall.
Now, for those of you joining us for the first time, welcome. Here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, we are working our way through J.R.R. Tolkien's Legendarium a few pages at a time.
We study the details, make connections to other writings, talk about our favorite themes.
And we have a lot of fun along the way, so we're glad you've joined us.
And we hope you'll be glad you joined as well. But once a quarter, we take a break from our read-through and welcome a few of our patrons to join us here in the common room and bring along some of their very best questions.
And we never have any idea what they're going to ask us. So as always, Alan and I are going to be answering their questions as best we can with the resources that are available to us right here in our recording nooks.
That's right. And between our ears, if we have any of those. Mm-hmm. And as with previous Questions After Nightfall episodes, aside from any possible edits for nervous coughs or time spent flipping through pages while we look for an answer, we will be presenting this as it was recorded live. Everything you hear in this show will have been recorded during this session.
And if you'd like to get in on the next one, go check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/prancingponypod. We'll continue recording these Questions After Nightfall episodes every quarter, and we'll be inviting patrons at the Elrond's Honorarium tier and higher to join us.
It's just one of the many ways we're saying thank you to our patrons, giving them the opportunity to get to know us a little better, make us laugh, stump us, and occasionally embarrass us in the best possible way.
It's all in good fun.
That's right. So, shall we go ahead and begin? Who do we have up first, Sean?
All right. Well, first up tonight, we have got Bruce.
All right. Bruce, welcome, sir.
Good evening, Megavon. And a little soft pitch for you here. What was each of your overall feeling of how the first PPP moot went off?
Oh, fun. So, folks, I know you're hearing this on July 4th, but we are recording this just a week and a few days after the end of the first PPP digital moot.
That's right.
Well, Bruce, I got to say, it went off surprisingly well. Maybe I shouldn't have said surprisingly. What do you think, Sean?
It does kind of make you wonder, well, wow, what were you expecting to happen? But
I didn't expect it to go that smoothly, that well, the whole time.
That's just it. It went amazingly well. And I almost don't want to say it out loud.
Jinx
you put
it.
That out in the universe and you jinx it for next year. But
seriously,
it really went incredibly smoothly. I've heard so much positive feedback about it, mm-hmm. which is really gratifying.
It is.
But I had a fantastic time. I thought
I did too.
All the presentations were wonderful. Mm-hmm. The hanging out with people on the Slack channels was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our happy hour events were great. I thought the whole thing went really, really well. It exceeded my wildest expectations. And I think I even said that.
Yeah, I think you did. And it did for me as well. And a lot of that, of course, has to do with our team.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, Jordan was phenomenal tech support the entire time. We had other tech support team, of course, as well. And then, of course, we had our amazing Rangers helping out, presenting each of the people who were giving their talks.
Yep.
And then, of course, above all of that was Katie.
Yeah.
Without her help, this did not get off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
We think it went well. We're super glad that we were able to do it. We had no idea we would end up with 400 people in attendance and that we would have, you know, Mike Trout, Amy Sturgis, Bill Fliss, and Tom Shippey as either keynotes or special guests. It was amazing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how we're going to top it next year. I don't even know if we can.
It's going to be tough, but I think it just was truly a magical weekend.
It really was.
Fantastic time.
Great question. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you for giving us a chance to relive it, Bruce.
Yeah.
And thank you for being there.
Yeah, that's right. Many of you were there. Sean, who's up next?
All right. Well, next up, we've got Carolyn.
Carolyn, hi.
Hi, guys. Carolyn, I'm living in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia right now.
Wow.
Wow.
That may be a record for the farthest away from us in a live recording.
Well, you know, I can still hear you like you're right next door.
I'm sorry. Well, welcome. Welcome back. What do you have for us tonight?
Okay, so, you know, rereading as we do, The Mirror of Galadriel. I found a comment by Frodo very interesting. This is when they're talking about wanting to see elf magic. And Frodo says, "I wouldn't, I'm content." And then he says, "And I don't miss Gandalf's fireworks, but his bushy eyebrows, his quick temper, and his voice."
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about that as a, you know, different side of the coin from the voice of Saruman.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought it was interesting that Frodo said those words, and Tolkien doesn't normally use words unless there's a purpose. So I just kind of wanted you guys to maybe, have you thought about that?
You know, I think I always put that in just in juxtaposition to Sam's comment previously, right? I mean, Sam was the one who was interested in seeing the elf magic. He talked about how you can't see the elf magic really because nobody's working it. There's no fireworks like Gandalf used to show. And I'd love to see some elf magic. And that's when Frodo makes his comment. And I think that's the only way I've ever looked at it before. But you make a good point. What does Frodo say he misses? He doesn't miss Gandalf's fireworks. He misses his eyebrows, his quick temper, and his voice. He misses the person of Gandalf, the friend of Gandalf that he remembers so dearly. But his voice is a key part of that. And you're right. As we go into the voice of Saruman, I think it's certainly worth contrasting the two. Sean?
Absolutely. I think we talked about this when we discussed this chapter, that Frodo misses the person. I think we use those words or something very similar to it. He misses all those human aspects of Gandalf. And to a certain degree, his flaws too, right? It's kind of like the warts and all.
The quick temper.
Remembrance of Gandalf. Know. Yeah, the quick temper. Let's ask Pippin if he misses Gandalf's quick temper.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Pippin's like, I could do without the quick temper bit. Yeah.
But, you know, it's like you would remember a lost loved one, maybe a parent or something. And you think, you know, oh, yeah, even when they were yelling at me, what I wouldn't give to have another moment of that, you know.
Yeah.
And those are the things that Frodo misses. He misses the person, not the wizard. And so I think along with that goes the fact that Frodo misses Gandalf's voice as just sort of the warm voice of a friend, the voice of counsel, the voice of support. And love and teaching that, you know, that he's always heard from Gandalf.
Yeah.
However, hearing you say that, Carolyn, I think that it is absolutely worth contrasting that with the voice of Saruman, which he uses as a weapon. He uses it as exactly the opposite of the way Gandalf does. Okay, the quick temper. Yeah, maybe he uses his voice as a weapon when he's angry. But generally speaking, you know, what Frodo's missing is the friendly times, the friendly words that Gandalf would say. And yeah, Saruman is, as we'll see when we get to that episode, which we're actually recording very soon here, Saruman actually has weaponized his voice and he uses it only for deceit, for controlling others. We might say mastering the minds of others.
Right.
And that is the exact opposite of how Gandalf uses his voice. So yeah, I think that is absolutely an on-point contrast. That's a really good catch.
That is a good catch. Carolyn, you have a quick follow-up on that.
Yeah, I was, I did think about that it was a contrast between him and Saruman, and that this universe was created by singing, and that Gandalf kindles people through his voice, and Saruman, like, uses that voice for complete evil.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that both Gandalf and Saruman, as Ainur, they would have had voices in the music.
That's true.
And how interesting it is that they both use their voices now.
Boy.
For good or for evil. Yeah.
It's a very, very good point, Sean. I mean, it's easy to forget about the Maiar having a voice because we always think about the powerful Valar. But of course, they're Ainur as well. So,
right. Absolutely.
Yeah, they have a part of the music, of course.
Yep.
Bruce, I see you've got your hand up. You have something to say to add to this?
Yes, please. Gandalf studied under Lorien and Nienna.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, pity and being able to kindle the hearts
of
the free people. And then Saruman under Aule, you know, mind of metal and wheels. So that's my only description.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah. It's always worth pointing out, you know, who they follow under.
Yeah.
I do feel badly. I feel like Aule is getting a bad rap sometimes because, of course, you know, we know that Saruman, Sauron, and Feanor all were, studies under Aule at one point or another. So he's definitely had some of the roughest kids in class. You know, he taught
the shop teacher had some of the rough kids.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah.
But, you know, It wasn't his fault. He was still a good teacher.
That's right. He was.
Even if he was on disciplinary action from the principal that one time. Well,
yeah, that's right. You did what in class, Ole?
You so did not have authority to do that in class.
You were supposed to build a birdhouse.
Yeah. Why are you building dwarves? Come on.
Living
creatures. That is not okay.
That is not
part of the
curriculum.
I don't want to get phone calls from these kids' parents.
Seriously, the district's going to haul me before a board meeting. I just don't have this. I'm done with you, man.
Why is Aule always the one with the problem children? I mean,
he is. I know.
I mean, we've talked about this before, and I know we'll.
Are you allowed to ask questions on Questions After Nightfall, Sean?
I absolutely am.
I don't know.
I co-host this podcast, sir. I'm allowed to ask a follow-up. Why is that, though, right?
I know.
I guess it just goes back to that whole idea of love not too well the work of thy hands,
yeah.
Right? You
yeah.
know, you create something, and you can create something beautiful. And Aule, I know all the Valar represent creation to a degree, but Aule represents craftsmanship.
Very
and
tangible creation, right?
Yeah, exactly, right. As the smith.
Mm-hmm. And he does a good job of not loving too well the works of his hands, right? I mean, the text tells us he loves to give things away.
Yeah. Absolutely. The one time that he made a mistake, he was willing to give up the work of his hands and smite him with that hammer.
That's right.
So he is absolutely good at keeping true to that commandment, I think Verlin Flieger calls it, the one commandment of Middle-earth.
Boy, that is a good one. Yeah.
But yeah, I guess that's just what Tolkien is trying to tell us.
I wonder if there's a little bit of self-warning in that from Tolkien. You know, as a sub-creator himself.
I think there absolutely is.
Is he sort of warning himself not to get too big for his britches, you know, not to think that you're equal to the creator.
Yeah.
To make that same mistake that Aule made. To remind himself, you know, to be humble. And that would certainly fit with what we know.
Thou art but mortal.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I think you're probably right about that. And I see that Rob has just posted into the chat, Aule is the Vala of the machine.
Yeah.
And remember Tolkien's words about, you know, fall, mortality, and the machine being sort of the main themes.
That is exactly. Those are the three main themes. That is correct.
But I think it's important to remember that Aule has good aspects too.
Oh, absolutely. Tremendous aspects. Mm-hmm. I mean, his generosity, his humility, his genuine repentance. This is a guy that, you know, we could certainly look at as a guide, I think, in many ways when we make mistakes, because we don't see that really with the other Valar. I mean, arguably their other biggest mistake was in bringing the elves over in the first place. But,
right.
You know, we don't see a lot of like very clear, oops, how do I fix this?
Right.
You know, it's sort of the anti-Melkor in that regard, because Melkor, you know, he just doubles down on all his wrong.
Right.
So, Marilyn, you've got a something to add to this as well. And then we probably need to move on to the next question, but fire away.
Yeah, I ran into an article recently that was comparing Fëanor and Faust. And what I thought was fascinating was the way he talked about the fine line between creativity and destruction. And when you look at the most creative of the folks that we see in Arda, they are often the ones who fall off the edge, as it were. I just thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that is absolutely true. We'll probably be talking about this again when we get to Saruman's voice in an episode or two.
Yeah, so. Exactly. All right. Well, we will.
All right.
Sean, who do we have up next?
Okay, well, next up, we've got Marilyn.
Marilyn.
Good evening, gentlemen. Hello, everyone. I'm Marilyn from Central Maine. As we record this, we are just finishing up on the podcast with Helm's Deep, possibly Middle-earth's most famous refuge. But Middle-earth is full of refuges, stony and arboreal, rustic and splendid, natural, artificial, enchanted, and even person-to-person. Which is your favorite scene of refuge in Middle-earth? And which refuge would you most like to visit?
My goodness.
Wow.
Well, we ask a variation of this in our North Wing segments, don't we? Because we always ask, you know, Rivendell or Lothlorien. And the answer is always Rivendell because people like libraries.
Right.
There are a number of refuges. The first one that came to mind is Henneth Anoon. I love that little scene.
Yeah.
I love that break. You know, these rangers of Ithilien far away from Minas Tirith, just having engaged in battle, and able to go to this place of safety where they can enjoy a meal, and we see some of their customs. Oh, it's a powerful moment. So I'd go with that one. It's the first one that came to mind.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm struggling.
That's all right.
Because I don't want to give the answer I always give.
How is Eärendil a refuge?
No.
I know.
The answer I always give to this question is Rivendell. And
yeah.
My first thought was, is Rivendell really a refuge? I mean, I guess you could define a lot of different places as a refuge, really.
Mm-hmm. True.
As Marilyn said, there's a lot of different places, people, and things that can be a refuge. And with that in mind, or even without that in mind, I think Rivendell is very clearly a refuge. It is the last homely house, after right. all. And so it is a place for you to go and escape your worries, your whatever terrifying nine monsters are chasing you. Yeah, I think Rivendell is absolutely a refuge. And I think it's probably my favorite and probably the one that I would want to spend a lot of time in mm-hmm. because of the library, because of the elvishness. It is very much my kind of fairy, you know, fairy yeah. through storytelling, which I think is very true to Tolkien's heart, mm-hmm. as opposed to something like Lothlorien, which is very much about sort of the fairy effect of being in this ancient forest. And
yeah,
that's all cool. It's just not me as much as Rivendell. However, to mix things up a little bit, since Marilyn did say person to person could work, I think that I would like to give a shout out to the refuge Frodo finds in his friendship with Sam.
Yes.
Because yes. a person can be a refuge. And we've all felt that a romantic relationship with someone can be a refuge. But here Tolkien is showing us that a good friend can be a refuge as well.
Absolutely.
And how powerful that can be. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have thought about it that way. But thanks to the brilliant way Marilyn worded the question, I'm absolutely going to call that one my favorite for now.
Wow, that opens up a whole bunch of new ideas, doesn't it? I mean, you think of the one we just read with the King of the Golden Hall and the sort of refuge that Gandalf gives to Théoden, you know,
yeah.
as he restores him, you know, brings him in to his wisdom and
yeah,
and encourages him so much. That's a huge moment as well.
And from all of that, Théoden is now able to have, eventually, in a few books' time, he's mm-hmm. able to have a noble death, and that's yeah. a refuge for him in
huge
his afterlife.
Refuge, that's right.
So that's pretty amazing.
Boy, that's fascinating. That really does open up yeah. a lot of things, doesn't it?
I think there's a lot. I think there's a lot of great refuge moments like that between people.
Mm-hmm. Even Bag End itself is a refuge, isn't it?
Oh, for yeah. sure. The Shire huge. Was one that I was thinking of. Yeah.
That's... But specifically even Bag End, you know, Bilbo gets away after the party, and where does he go? He goes back to his house, where it's a refuge from the 144 under the party tree, and all he's mm-hmm. got to do is deal with Gandalf.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Shire itself.
I'm also thinking of Beren and Lúthien. It's a weird one because that's such a mythic story. It's not quite as human as Lord of the Rings, but I was just rereading Beren and Lúthien and, you know, the refuge those two found in each other.
Oh, absolutely.
And you think about how closely that story resonated with Tolkien himself and his relationship with Edith. And I guess that's why I said what I said a little while ago about, you know, a refuge in a romantic relationship, which is what yeah. we see there. But yeah, there's a lot of great ones. And honestly, I'm actually reserving the right to bring that up again, Marilyn, when we yeah. get to a good refuge moment in the book. We might just bring this idea up again and give you a little hat tip.
I think so. I mean, I'm thinking one that came to mind was Bilbo giving refuge to Frodo. But what I really think is that Frodo was in a way a refuge for Bilbo, who was otherwise by himself, had no family.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, you think, oh, I'm giving a home to this young orphaned hobbit, but what you're really doing is giving yourself a son, essentially.
Yeah.
An heir, certainly.
A son and an heir and also someone to connect with, too.
Yeah.
Because Bilbo was seriously hurting for anyone that he could form a connection with.
And such an outcast in his own community. After
right,
adventures.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. So he definitely was a refuge for Bilbo and probably in a way gave Bilbo hope for the future.
Man,
so
fun topic.
A fantastic question, Marilyn. Thank
really,
you.
Really good question, Marilyn. Arthur, you've got your hand raised on this one. Go ahead. What do you have for us?
Well, I just want to say in the interest of equity, we were being very good guy-centric here. I was thinking of Shelob's Lair, which was a refuge not only for a poor wounded spider, but for Gollum. And there are refuges on the other side as well. And I think it might be interesting at some point to talk about that.
That is interesting. I wouldn't have thought of Gollum finding refuge in Shelob's Lair, but maybe. Does he feel safe there? Does he feel protected there? Or does it give him a place to hide? I don't know. Maybe it's the same thing.
Yeah.
I will say for sure that Gollum's cave that he lived in under the Misty Mountains, that was certainly a refuge.
Yeah.
Because that was his safe place where he could keep
after
his ring.
Throttling an orc.
Throttle an orc every once in a while. But yeah, I'll grant you that, Arthur. Maybe Shelob's Lair is a refuge for Gollum. We'll take a closer look at that when we get there.
And get there we will in another year or so.
That's right.
All right. Well, Sean, who do we have up next?
All right. Well, next up, we've got Joe.
All right, Joe, welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm Joe from Western Washington, outside of Seattle.
All right, welcome. So many Pacific Northwest folks we have, not necessarily tonight, but just in general. You got a big crowd up there.
We're major groupies.
Well, welcome, Joe. Good to have you.
Thank you very much. So my question is, when Treebeard initially meets Merry and Pippin, he warns them about giving out their right names, and then he does not give out his. But later, as he's carrying the hobbits, he starts chanting about the seasons and about First Age locations.
Yes.
So since these locations are from the First Age, it is possible that Merry and Pippin wouldn't have either known about them or wouldn't have context to put them in. Mm-hmm. So I was puzzled about Treebeard's intent. And I was wondering if, given the language patterns of the Ents, could he have actually been giving Merry and Pippin part of his name in Westron? And then furthermore, when the Ents are chanting as they're marching to Isengard, could they actually be extending their own name?
Wow.
Oh, I certainly think the latter is true for sure. That becomes a part of who they are, which then, boy, that's an interesting question.
Becomes part of their name. If an Entish name tells a story, which is...
Yeah, and the story of their entire lives.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I do note that Treebeard doesn't say, I'm never going to tell you my real name. He says, I'm not going to tell you my name, not yet, at any rate.
Right.
He has to warm up to them a little bit. Mm-hmm. And
names have power. He wants to trust
right.
them. Yeah,
absolutely. And he does get to the point where he trusts them. So yeah, maybe so.
But could he tell them his name in any amount of time that would pass before their deaths by old age?
Well, probably not. I mean, he probably can't tell them his true name.
No.
Maybe he can give them a bit of it.
A taste of it. Well, that's a good question then. Is the poem, in the willow meads of Tisaran and I walked in the spring, is that a way of expressing part of his name? Because this is his story.
Maybe so. Was that actually an Entish song or was that an Elvish song? I can't remember.
Oh, that's a very good point. Because that would... Well, it's all first person. No, that's...
Yeah, that's true. It was the Ent and the Entwife was the Elvish song, wasn't it?
That's correct. Right. Ent and Entwives was an Elvish song.
Yeah, you're right. So... Maybe so. I mean, we're getting into semantics about what's a name and what's a story, right?
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thought. It's a very compelling idea that anything he says to describe himself is now part of his name. That's kind of cool. I like that.
I like that, too. I mean, he would be the one who walked in the willow meads of Tisaranen in the spring and who walked in the elm woods of Osiriand in summer by the seven rivers of Osir in the light and the music and... Yeah, I mean, I can see how some of that would fit in his name. I don't think this is intentionally him giving them his name. If so, it's even too obtuse for Treebeard. I mean,
well, and I guess you can draw that conclusion out to the point where it just becomes kind of ridiculous. Like if anything he says to describe himself is really part of his name, then
right.
Anytime he talks, he's giving part of his name.
Then the entire time he's talking about the past, he's giving his name.
Maybe it's not quite that literal, but in a certain sense, anything that becomes part of his identity and his experience is going to be worked into his name at some
True.
Point. But
portions but maybe of that would be in his name
right,
for sure.
Right, exactly. Right?
I mean, maybe not that exact chant, because really, at the end, you realize it's a lament. You wonder how much of that, though, but certainly the bits about where he was and when he was there would be part of his name.
You would think it should be, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
It does make you wonder, though, do the Ents consider something like Treebeard or Fangorn not their real name? Do they consider it an abbreviated form of their real name? Or do they consider it just like sort of an everyday use name, kind of like an Earthsea?
Yeah.
But yeah, is Treebeard like Sparrowhawk? Is that just like his use name that he can give to anybody? I don't know. It's interesting.
Interesting. I don't know that's a question that has an answer that we can ever get to, but it certainly is an interesting
True.
Question to discuss, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
I like the idea, though, of all of the involved Ents adding to their name, he who stormed Isengard.
Yeah.
Marched off to war.
Right.
Because those right. are going to be added to their names. You can bet that.
And it just starts to become like a really long royal style, you know, like I am Quickbeam who hung out with the Rowans and then was sad when they were destroyed and then marched on Isengard. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
And ate orcs for breakfast.
Yeah, exactly.
With 2% milk.
As you do.
As a breakfast cereal.
As a breakfast cereal. And fruit bats.
Well played, sir. All right. Who's next, Sean?
Okay, next up we have got Rob.
Rob, welcome, sir.
Welcome, and thank you. I'm from Houston, Texas.
All right.
All right. Texas in the house, Rob. Good to have you.
Part of the Houston smile down there?
Well, if they'll take me.
I think they probably will.
I think they will.
You let Chad High and his cohort know that you've got our stamp of approval.
Awesome. Well, my question is entitled, Aragorn and Gollum, Not a Love Story.
Right? That's very accurate.
So we know from the Council of Elrond and the awesome reading of that was at the Moot that Aragorn captured Gollum in the Dead Marshes, and then he took him on a 900-mile hiking tour of Middle-earth, ending in Thranduil's kingdom, dragging him all the way. On that journey, he walked right by Lothlorien, where he was known and had the favor of the lady. Wouldn't Lothlorien be a much better place to keep Gollum and a shorter journey?
Yeah, in theory, but one wonders if they have a jail. I think we all know that Thranduil has a prison, and that may just been the most practical version of that answer. It's the one that comes to my mind first, at least, is that, you know, we know they have cells, not that they ended up keeping him in there. That's an interesting question. Yeah. I mean, yeah, one would think that, okay, let me think strategically, though. There's another reason why not to put him there. If, in fact, Sauron and his forces do try to come and free Gollum, the last thing you want is for them to know where one of the three Elven Rings is. You don't want to reveal Galadriel in any way, and so you take him to some other kingdom. That might be the more strategic answer. Sean, what do you think?
I think that is a better answer than what I was going to say, which is that maybe Lorien just wasn't going to have him. Like, that's not a favor you can ask for from Lorien. Yeah. You know?
Galadriel's like, I'm giving you my granddaughter. I am not going to house that guy.
That, and also just like, you would have to be pretty arrogant to ask Lothlorien to keep your Scungy prisoner, you know? Yeah.
Scungy. I love that word.
Thank you.
I'm going to borrow that word, man.
You're welcome to it. They're just not going to do it. And I just don't think that it was an option, but I actually like your answer better. There's a very good strategic reason not to bring Gollum anywhere near.
Yeah. Nenya. The last thing you want is the Eye of Sauron anywhere near Lothlorien.
Yeah. I mean, by the same token, why didn't Aragorn bring him to Rivendell?
Difficulty of going over the mountains there. I think there's a practical thing, but yeah, also strategic, right?
That's true.
I think both those places, you're right. We have the strategic reason of not drawing the eye of the enemy there, but both of them also have the practical reasons of Lothlorien not having a jail, right? Not having dungeons.
As far as we know.
Ground. Yeah. And Rivendell, the practicality of getting there being a very difficult place from that side of the mountains. It'd just be a little easier to go further north and into Mirkwood.
Right. But that Thranduil guy, he's got jails.
We know he's got jails. Just ask Glowin and, you know, 12 other dwarves. Yeah.
You are less tender to me.
I love that line. Man. They didn't let the dwarves get out for a breather every day and climb the trees. Not that the dwarves would have wanted to climb trees, mind you.
But no, they would not have.
I'm sure they would have liked a little fresh air.
I'm sure they would have liked some of that delicious roasted meat they were smelling in the forest.
Seriously. What were you doing in the forest? We were starving.
Why did you come after our people? Because we were starving.
I love that. I love Thorin's droll response.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Beautiful.
One of the best things.
Favorite moments in the book. Starving. Do I need to remind you again? Dying from hunger? Starving?
Hello. Starving. We were starving. Why weren't you listening?
Oh, man.
Seriously.
Oh, Thranduil. Yeah. Anyway. All right. That was a great question, though. I like that because I really do think there are both practical and very important strategic answers to those both.
Yeah.
All right. Sean, who's up next?
Next up, we've got Arthur.
Arthur, have you been on the show before? You'd sound familiar.
I think I might have at one point.
I think so, sir.
This is Arthur, currently living in Baltimore. If you want to, you can call me Tevildur. That's a different discussion. And aside from thanking y'all from the wonderful experience at the PPP Moot, which was a great deal of fun.
Yes.
Because of that, I'm so grateful to you, I am not going to ask you whether if Sesame Street did a Silmarillion skit, would it be Olmo's world?
Oh.
What I do want to ask you is something that occurred to me some time ago when we did, had a little discussion on the web, on the Facebook page, but I'd like to post it to y'all directly. Three elven rings.
Yeah.
Gandalf has Narya, the Ring of Fire.
Yes.
Gandalf kindles hearts, hopefully not literally. Oh, Gandalf does fireworks. Gandalf has been known to set the occasional wolf on fire.
That he has.
Galadriel has Nenya, the Ring of Water. She pours a ewer of water into her bird bath, breathes on it, and makes a magic mirror.
That's true.
She lives on a river. She does water stuff. Elrond has Vilya, the mightiest of the three, the Ring of Air. The yep. only thing I can think of that that has anything to do with Elrond, Rivendell, and Air is smells like elves.
Fair.
So my question is, can anybody think of at any point where Elrond was working with Air as you might expect him to from having the Ring of Air?
That's a very good question. Go ahead, Sean.
I do think I have one.
I think yeah. I might have one as well.
Elrond can talk for hours and hours and hours at a council meeting and never run out of breath.
That is true. He certainly can. That isn't the answer I was thinking of, but it's brilliant.
No? I think we speculated that maybe the magic at the Ford of Bruinen.
That's correct.
Ford of Bruinen. Now 0% for 72 months if you buy now.
Right. That might have actually been not an effect directly on the water itself, but working on the air to whip
right.
up the water into the horses.
Think about what the surface of a lake looks like in a strong wind. It looks like an ocean. You get these massive waves that are coming from the wind.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's how the flood came. I don't think it was just water, because that water would have to come from somewhere. I
yeah.
think it was a push of the water via air. All the cars at Ford of Bruinen come with air conditioning.
There you go. Free air in every Ford.
Free air at Ford of car
at Ford of Bruinen.
And now I do want to admit that when we had this conversation before on the show, we were looking for an explanation that fit with the ring.
Right.
For very much a similar reason to what you're saying, Arthur, is like, well, yeah, Gandalf's got the metaphorical fire of kindling hearts.
And a quite literal fire if you ask the pine cones
of the
fireworks,
or right.
the wolves, and of course the fireworks, right?
Right. Galadriel has got the water thing in a very literal sense with the mirror, and there's possibly some metaphorical water stuff with just sort of her living close to a river, like Arthur says.
Right.
Even
right.
to some degree, maybe the flow of time could be likened to a river.
Yeah.
And you could talk about that a little bit. But yeah, we kind of were thinking of, okay, what's the literal elemental source of that magic? And that's kind of what we came up with.
I like, though, the Elrond that doesn't stop talking.
Well, yeah.
I thought that was great.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the metaphorical piece of it. I do want to give a shout out to Marilyn, though, in the chat, who said that metaphorically air represents thought and mind and to some degree magia. And
oh, wow, that's interesting.
I had exactly the same thought on that. I think metaphorically yeah. it could be Elrond's intellectual capacity that is enhanced by Vilya to some degree. But in the more literal elemental sense, yeah, I think the Ford counts.
Yeah, works for me. Marilyn, you've got a little bit to add on that one. What do you have?
Yeah, the Hermetic tradition, which came out of Egypt, was the basis for European alchemy. And they had a system of four elements, earth, air, fire, water, and air traditionally represented thought, the mind, and so forth. So this was very familiar to medieval thought. And I hazard a guess that that's where Tolkien got it from, though I can't point to any sources at this point. Give me time.
Of course.
Maybe I can.
Marilyn, wasn't water equated with time in that same framework?
Water is more emotions.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And water was associated with the ancestors because it was associated with the West, and that's where the ancestors dwelt. This is in Celtic tradition. Other traditions had somewhat different associations, but...
Interesting.
I don't know of any elemental association with time. That's an interesting question.
Interesting. Well, ancestors and the West, that
Hello?
Certainly fits with Galadriel too. Yeah.
Yeah, it sure does.
Very cool. All right. Well, and to close that one out, Arthur has said in the chat that if Elrond and Gandalf get together, it's a lot of hot air.
And that if Gandalf and Galadriel got together, she gets steamed. Oh, man.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, on that note, let's go to Chad.
Chad Bornholt in Texas, as everyone already understands.
Probably, yeah.
So,
Chad in Texas.
The famous Chad in Texas.
Yeah. So anyway, speaking of Rivendell, with everyone listening to the Council of Elrond play that Jordan and I and 32 other people put together. Mm-hmm. I was posed a really good question recently, and I thought it would be great to run this by y'all on the air.
Sure.
Aragorn says that the Rangers protect everyone that Gondor's stalwart tower cannot, in particular Bree.
Right.
And I quote a little bit of that. He says, "And yet less thanks have we than you. Travelers scowl at us, and countrymen give us scornful names. Strider I am to one fat man who lives within a day's march of foes that would freeze his heart or lay his little town in ruin if he were not guarded ceaselessly." End quote.
Yes.
So I doubt he's referring to orcs or men because he says they would freeze Barlaman's heart. And by Barlaman, I do not mean Becca Davis.
No, I didn't think he did.
Okay. That line leads you to think of Barrow Whites if, you know, if they freeze his heart, but that seems unlikely because even the Shire knows about them, and if he doesn't know about them, to which enemies is Aragorn referring?
That's a very good question. My initial thought is just, you know, your heart is frozen with fear. So anyone that would cause fear. So yeah, I mean, even orcs, I think, could cause him to be frozen in fear. But the line is, lives within a day's ride of foes who would freeze his heart. So what enemies live within a day's ride of Bree?
Day's march.
A day's march.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. A day's march. Day's march is a lot shorter than a day's ride. And that really would leave either the Wights or maybe the trolls up in the Trollshaws. Not that trolls are organized enough to have a march, but you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. My mind is sadly conflating the text with the stuff in Lotro, and I'm thinking of all the, up at Forest Shell, I'm thinking of all the enemies up there. I'm thinking of, you know, all the bad guys, you know, the brigands, the Wights come to mind, I think.
I like the idea that the Wights are what's meant here because the Wights do have that kind of power, you know, to sort of literally freeze one's heart. But the thing is, the Wights aren't going anywhere.
No.
The Wights are not going to go to Bree and lay the town in ruin. So that's why I'm not sure that's who Aragorn is talking about. I mean,
yeah.
Unless he's talking about two different things. Maybe he's saying, okay,
the ones who would freeze his heart and the ones who would lay ruin to the town.
Right. Maybe that's it. But I was with you, Alan. My initial thought was that Aragorn is just talking about freeze his heart in the sense of scare him half to death.
Right, right.
Because they're terrifying monsters and he's an innkeeper. I wasn't thinking of it quite that literally, but it is an interesting question. Who actually is a day's march from there? And it is Wights and trolls. I mean, there might be some roving goblins.
Yeah.
But we've never encountered them in any of the books that have gone through there. So.
Yeah. A day's march of foes that would freeze his heart or lay his little town in ruin. Yeah. Maybe that is two different sets of foes.
Maybe.
But yeah, I think really in general, any foe.
Any foes would freeze Barlaman.
Is
going to
freeze
Barlaman. Let's be honest.
Barlaman is a softie, and I don't mean that as an insult. You know, again, no reference to our own particular Barlaman. I'm talking about the textual Barlaman Butterbur. He's a businessman, you know. He's not an adventurer.
No. He's an innkeeper. He'll cook you a good meal. He'll brew you a good mug of ale.
Brigands would freeze his heart. Orcs certainly would. Wights, trolls, even more so.
Strider freezes his heart. I mean,
just
come
about.
On.
I mean, he is afraid.
He's scared
of Strider.
Of Strider.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. He's frankly even a little bit afraid of Gandalf.
It's true. Yeah, he's going to put a curse on his ale.
Yeah.
I think that's what Aragorn means there. I don't know that he's being all that literal and talking about the Wights, but maybe.
Could be. Folks, the good news is I think we're going to be able to get a second round of questions in, but we're going to go ahead and do that after our break. So, for now, we want to take a moment to remind our listeners to please check out our website, theprancingponypodcast.com.
Yes, indeed. All the good stuff is there. Show notes, outtakes, Prancing Pony ponderings, and also our online storefront, where you can get PPP shirts, mugs, stickers, and more.
And of course, one of the best resources we have at the website is our library page. After all, we love the books here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, and we want to make sure that you can get your hands on any of the books that we mention here.
Yeah, we may talk about a lot of different Tolkien-related stuff on the podcast, but at heart, Alan and I are fans of Tolkien's books and books about Tolkien. That's why we have the library page, with links to every book we've mentioned on the show.
Now, we do make a few pennies from the purchases you make from those links, and we thank you for your support. Well, now it's time to head back into the common room for some more questions. Sean, who's up to start round two?
To start round two, we've got Marilyn again.
All right. Well, Marilyn.
Yes, I have a speculative one for you this time. Well, I guess the last one was
excellent.
Anyway, we know what happens to Elrond and Galadriel and the elves at the end of the story. I was wondering, what do you suppose happens to Tom Bombadil and to Goldberry?
Oh, my.
I have a theory.
Why don't you start? Because right now I'm a little stumped.
I have absolutely nothing to base this on, except for my own desire for what happens to a kind of a nature spirit at the end of this story. I think that Tom and Goldberry survive into the Fourth Age, possibly the Fifth. But I think that over time, they gradually wane. They start to maybe not fade quite like the elves, but as Middle-earth becomes a less and less enchanted place and it becomes more and more the world that we know and the history that we know, I think in time they fade into, I shouldn't say fade, but I just said it. It's fine. But they kind of wane and they just become part of the landscape over time.
Yeah, I think their power wanes. I mean, I think the first thing that came to my mind was the idea that their realm would shrink and shrink and shrink.
Yeah, yeah.
And that they would withdraw. You know how we hear about the hobbits, right? The way they're talked about in the prologue.
Yeah.
And how, oh, they used to be like this, but now, you know, they're even more secretive and they're harder to find and all of this.
Yeah.
They've even become shorter, right? They used to be 3.5 to 4 feet tall and now they're not.
Right.
I don't think necessarily Tom and Goldberry physically shrink because they're talking about generations. But I do think their realm shrinks. I think their power probably shrinks a little bit as well. Their influence. But I think they stay.
I think they're still around, but
they won't be able to be found, I don't think.
No, I think they've sort of dissipated into the natural world in some way. You know, their power is still there, their spirit is still there, but maybe it can't take shape anymore.
That could be.
Maybe it can't communicate with others anymore, except maybe through imagined whispers and, you know, just a vague feeling that you get when you visit a place.
I can buy that.
I think it becomes very much like our idea of nature spirits in the world. People who go to a place that, you know, they feel something. They just feel a power, a presence, and maybe it's something like that.
A vague, sort of unidentifiable thing. But yeah.
I can't prove it, but I like it.
Is that vague, unidentifiable thing speaking to them in rhythmic couplets? And
Old Tom's here, don't you know? Wish I had a body. Yeah.
If I had a body, it would be wearing yellow boots and a bright blue hat.
It's hard, isn't it? I know.
I can't just make it up.
But yeah, I think that's consistent with what we see happen to most of the fairy things in Tolkien's world.
Yeah.
You know, we know that elves actually do fade over time.
Yes.
And that's why I'm trying to avoid the word fade for Tom and Goldberry.
Yeah, because they are different creatures altogether.
Exactly. But I think that we would probably see that any creature that's not human is going to change and is going to diminish over time.
That's a better word.
I know, but it makes me think of Cate Blanchett.
Ah, yes. I will diminish.
Exactly.
The rest and remain.
Remain Galadriel.
Galadriel. Well, of course you're going to remain Galadriel. Who else are you going to be?
I hope so. Celeborn certainly hopes so.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I think.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. I think the diminishing and the shrinking realm, but they're still going to stay there. They still are.
Yeah.
Remember who is Tom? And the answer was just, he is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing. I don't think he could ever not be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. And I want to just give Marilyn a shout out because she just typed in the text, the ineffable feeling I get in the English countryside.
Yes.
And of course, because that is exactly what Tom is.
Tom is the spirit
of the English countryside. So I think that could be exactly what Tolkien had in mind, is that he's now just sort of become part of the landscape. He's just a feeling. I like it.
I don't know that I'd say he's just a feeling. I mean, really, I think he's more than a feeling.
Oh, man. Of course he is.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. Well, Sean, who do we have next here in the second round?
Next up, we've got a second question from Arthur.
Oh, no.
Arthur.
Why am I
It's always the questions
this?
He doesn't ask that we regret.
I have to give a pass on the unasked question this time, because when I listened to the live recording from the moot, I think I messed up the unasked question and said that the trolls were made in mockery of elves instead of ents, which would have been cute. But so I'll let you have this one.
Teeny
for free.
Tiny trolls.
I was rereading and re-listening for about the 56th episode of The Council of Elrond over on the Tolkien Professor's website. And it got to the point where Bilbo says, I'll take the ring, don't worry. And Elrond says, well, maybe not, but who's going to take the ring? And they're all sitting around looking up into the corner and trying not to look at anyone until Frodo volunteers. And it occurred to me that if they had picked someone else, they would have had to kill Frodo to get the ring away from him to give to the other person. Was there really any point other than Elrond trying to make dramatic tension there simply because you can't take the ring away from Frodo? It'll break his mind.
That's a very good point.
So how could they even consider anybody else except, as I said, for the dramatic tension?
Wow. That is a really good question, Arthur. I mean, folks all remember the movie with the ring sitting there on the plinth, but that isn't at all what the book says. In fact, after they're talking about it and Aragorn is exposed, Aragorn is, well, not literally.
It's not that kind of party. Come on.
No, it's not that kind of party. You know, Frodo's like, oh, it belongs to you and not to me. And then Gandalf says, bring out the ring, Frodo. The time has come. Hold it up, and then Boromir will understand the remainder of his riddle.
Hold it up.
Right. Hold it up. Not set it down or anything like that. And in fact, when he does that, he feels a great reluctance to reveal the ring.
Right.
A loathing of its touch. He wished he was far away. But then he holds it up in his hand.
Right.
And we even read that again later, right? Boromir says, I have seen a shining ring, a bright ring in the halfling's hand.
Right. Nothing says that Frodo put it on a table in the middle of the room.
There's
where
no
anybody
evidence.
Could grab it and run off with it, by the way.
Which is a very bad idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the whole point is, folks, Frodo always had the ring. And Arthur asks a very good question, because the last time somebody really wanted to look at the ring before this was Bilbo the night before, you know, in the Hall of Fire. And, you know, turns into this terrifying little creature in the eyes of Bilbo or in the eyes of Frodo.
Yeah.
And that was a terrifying moment. It would have been hard for Frodo to give the ring even to Bilbo, you know, to touch it again.
Yeah. So it would have been very hard for Frodo to give up the ring to put it on a table if there was a table there.
It very well might have broken his mind. You're right.
And it just seems like it would have been a very bad idea to put the ring right there in the middle where anybody could
grab it. Terrible idea. Yeah. Because then somebody might whack it with an axe.
Yeah.
It's pointless.
it's a good way to break your axe.
Yeah, exactly. Very good way to break your axe. Or break your teeth as your entire body just kind of, you know, from the handle. But yeah. I mean, Boromir, we know, wants it. He's fast. He's got a horse.
Yeah.
He could just grab it and run.
I mean, he probably wouldn't make it out of there, but still.
No,
yeah,
probably
it's
not.
It's just not a good idea. Don't tempt fate like that. And so, yeah, it does beg the question, if Frodo had not been the one to take the ring, what would they have done?
Question.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking of Boromir hearing in his mind, take the money and run from Steve Miller Band.
Oh, man. That's awful. I mean, it's par for the course.
This here's the story of Boromir and his horse.
It works surprisingly well and also surprisingly terribly.
Yeah. Well, it's me singing it, so it's not surprisingly terrible. All right. Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I don't know that anybody else could have without damaging Frodo, but I don't think Elrond was doing this for dramatic purposes. I think he really was trying to figure out who was going to carry the ring, who was going to take it.
There is another possibility. There is a possibility that Frodo says, I am not going to take the ring to Mordor. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's too big for me.
I don't want it.
Yeah, I don't want to do this, and I am going to give the ring to someone else to do it.
And voluntarily giving up the ring.
Voluntarily gives the ring up to somebody else.
Exactly.
If he does that, then we're fine. It's only if Frodo says, I don't want to take the ring to Mordor, and by the way, I'm keeping the ring.
Right, I'm taking it home.
Then we have problems anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So, because then we have him going full Gollum on us, and yeah, that ends badly for everybody.
That does end very badly for everyone.
I mean, maybe not for everybody. It ends badly for Frodo.
It ends very badly for Frodo, but it could end badly for a few people in the meantime.
It could, yeah.
So, Arthur, you've got a quick follow-up on this one before we go to the next question.
Yeah, I was thinking you were talking about Frodo giving up the ring to someone else voluntarily as opposed to being taken from him by force. I think, as I read the text at this point, he's beyond that. I don't think he could give it to anyone.
But I don't know that Elrond knows that.
Well, you know, he's got that ring full of air and everything. He's got to know something.
Fair.
Gandalf's been talking to Elrond, and Gandalf already said, if I take the ring, it would break Bilbo's mind.
Gandalf saw how reluctant Frodo was to even throw the ring in the fire. Mm-hmm. I can't think that Gandalf would not have briefed Elrond.
That's a good point.
Interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Chad has just posted in the chat. There's the moment in the council when Frodo springs to his feet.
Yeah, it's right after Aragorn is revealed. Yeah,
right. And he says, then it belongs to you and not to me at all. He was ready to give up the ring to Aragorn at that point.
I don't know about ready. It was as if he expected the ring to be demanded. So
yeah, but he didn't like hide from it. He didn't.
No, that's true.
He didn't like pull away and like, oh, I'm worried that this guy is going to try and take the ring from
it's me. It's my ring. Yeah, he didn't go that way.
Yeah, he offered it up.
That's a very good point.
Maybe he was ready to give it up there, although we don't know for sure what happens if he's actually tested.
Yeah, you're right. You know, everybody has faced that temptation. Some of them have prepared ahead of time. You know how we talked about Aragorn being prepared for that temptation, Gandalf being prepared for that temptation, and even Galadriel to some extent.
Yeah. And he is just springing to his feet. It's not like he's springing to his feet and holding out the ring to give it to him.
No, but nor is he springing to his feet and pulling out Sting.
No, but he is springing to his feet, so he's ready for action.
He is.
This could be a going to give you the ring, or it could also be a fight or flight response.
Yeah.
I think it's the former, but we don't know for sure.
No, we don't. We don't know at all.
That's a fascinating question, Arthur.
Well, Marilyn, you've got a quick follow-up on this, and then we do need to move on to the next question in this round.
Yeah, I do. Thanks. I really think that the underlying point is that Elrond cannot order anybody to take the ring. He knows this only too well. And the reason why he's not looking at anybody in particular is because he's waiting for somebody to offer. And as he says, if I've heard everything aright, then yes, you are the best choice. But I cannot lay it on you. If you take it freely, then I will say your choice is right.
Right. I think the question, though, comes to the idea is if Elrond's known all along that Frodo's going to have to be the one to choose to do it, is the entire Council of Elrond theater? Are all of these pages and all of this conversation intended to push Frodo to the point where he decides to take the ring? I don't know that that's the case. I don't know.
I feel like we've talked about this before. I feel like we've talked about this before, and we did come to the idea that maybe this was not theater, but it was all about building consensus, because as we know, something can be faded, and yet people still need to act of their own free will. This is a big project. Even though it's fated for Frodo to take the ring,
he still has to choose.
He still has to choose, and the rest of the assembled people at the council have to choose to let him do it.
That is a key point, yes.
All the free peoples of Middle-earth need to exercise free will to allow this halfling to do this.
This is a way to give everybody the exposition they need. Frodo already knows a big piece of the story. You know, Legolas knows none of the story. All the other people involved, they all know some of the story. They just don't know all of the story.
Right.
Or as Paul Harvey would say, they don't know the rest of the story.
Consensus decision-making takes longer, but it's a stronger decision in the end.
Indeed it is.
Yeah, agreed. Totally agreed. So, yeah, it could be that Elrond has just realized at the end of the council that this task was appointed for Frodo. Maybe he didn't know all along. And so we still needed the council to get to that point. But once the decision is made, then Elrond in his wisdom and his elvish foresight can say, oh yeah, of course, this feels right. And maybe that's what's going on there.
Maybe. We hope so.
All right. Well, just entering the virtual studio, we've got a surprise guest, Tom. Tom, why don't you go ahead and ask a question since you haven't before?
Hi, I'm Tom from New York. The question I have is, I think ties into the one you were just talking about. In the Shadow of the Past, Gandalf says to Frodo, I can put it no plainer than this. You were meant to find the ring. Bilbo was meant to find the ring and not by its maker, in which case you were also meant to have the ring.
Yes.
Why can he put it no plainer?
Because arguably it could be put plainer, couldn't it?
Could have been a lot plainer, really, and helped Frodo out a lot, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we could have said specifically that the maker of this entire world, for whom the music, you know, is his will and all shall be fated within it, he intended Bilbo to find the ring. That isn't what he says. I can put it no plainer. Perhaps what he means is, I am not allowed to put it any plainer than this.
Mm-hmm.
That could be one option. Sean, what do you think?
I think that works. Maybe he's not allowed. He knows, but to reveal the knowledge that he has, it would be to reveal his power in some sense.
Yeah.
You know, hey.
His origin, right? Because to everybody else, he's just this old wanderer.
Right.
Yeah.
Although he's still Gandalf the Grey at this point. So I don't know that he has the bat phone to Iluvatar that he has as Gandalf the White.
No, but I think he knows. I mean, not he doesn't know in the direct communication sense. He knows in the logical deduction sense. Yeah, he's aware that the ring would never have intended Bilbo to find it. Therefore, somebody else meant to. And the only other entity that could mean for Bilbo to find it would be Eru Iluvatar.
But if he just knows that from a logical deduction and not from some revealed knowledge, then how would saying, I came to this logical conclusion, how would that reveal his power? How would that be something he'd be forbidden?
Oh, well, that's a good point. Because he would still be basing that logical conclusion on what he knows of Iluvatar being an Ainu.
Maybe. I mean, he could be basing it on faith. I guess a person could say that too and just be basing it on faith. But
except that there's not a lot of, you know, there's, as far as we know, there are no written teachings about Eru's guidance.
True.
For instance, there's no that's inspired true. Scripture, let's say.
True.
And so Bilbo wouldn't be able to, and Frodo wouldn't be able to draw on a common knowledge of that set of tales, that story. I don't even know whether the hobbits have any inkling of creation. I mean, certainly we know the elves are aware of the music, and we know that the men of Numenor are, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And we know the dwarves know at least that Ale is their maker. I mean, they call him somebody else.
I always feel like hobbit expressions like glory and trumpets hint at some sort of concept of some sort of theology, but you're right. I mean, they don't really seem to have any sort of worship or anything like that, or scripture or anything like that.
Interesting.
So it could just be that maybe they learned second or third hand stuff about theology from the men of Numenor or the men of Arnor.
Right.
And they've absorbed things like glory and trumpets, sort of like little corruptions of actual references to divine beings. That's really funny.
Yeah.
But no, the only other idea I have, I like your answer, Alan. I think that's a really good answer. The other possibility is that maybe he can't say any more because saying more will push Frodo in a particular direction.
Fair. That could be it as well.
And maybe he just wants Frodo to just know it's okay. You are meant to have the ring. This is right. It doesn't feel right. And I know you're scared, but this is right. This is how things are supposed to be right now. So just go with what feels right. And
fair.
We'll see what happens. Maybe that's what he's doing. And he's worried if he says like, well, I think there's a divine plan at work. And I think you're going to be instrumental in undoing this thing. Mm-hmm. Either that spurs Frodo to action, and then maybe he makes the wrong decision, or he makes the
right
decisions for the wrong reasons, or maybe it just terrifies Frodo and he doesn't leave.
Yeah, exactly. I'm never going anywhere, man. Are you kidding
it's
me?
Like, man, I do not want to be called, man. This is not what I signed up for.
So yeah, I think there's a number of reasons why he can put it no plainer in terms of either permitted information or it's not wise for me to put it any plainer because doing so would put too much pressure on you.
Yeah.
Or could put too much pressure on you, right?
Yeah.
That's a great question though, Tom. I love that. I've never even thought about that. I can put it no plainer. Well, actually you could have.
Can you try? Maybe
can you make an effort? I mean, give it a go.
Right.
I'll let you know if it's any plainer. You just try saying it another way. Yeah. That's a great question. All right. Well, Sean, who do we have in this next round?
Next up, we've got Joe. Joe, do you have another question for us?
I do. And speaking of music, so if you think about the musical speech patterns of some characters like Tom Bombadil and the Race of the Ents, do you think that there is a relationship between the musical speech patterns and the representation of either the individual or the race in the music of the Ainur? You know, the Ents were in the music, although Manwë conveniently forgot that until he was reminded about it. And of course, elves were in the music. Tom Bombadil, we don't know if he was or not, but contrast that with, say, like the dwarves, who were not, at least not directly that we know of. I mean, they could have been embedded somewhere.
Fair.
And while they have music, they don't necessarily, there's not that sonorous nature to their speech. So what I was looking at is there a relationship between how people describe themselves and the language that they use to not only describe themselves and their environment, but how closely they were bound to the music, to use Dr. Fleeger's words.
Okay, so the idea being that
the more musical races are more closely bound to the music than less musical races.
It's an interesting notion. Wow, I don't know, Sean.
I'm inclined to say no, but let's talk about it and let's see where I end up.
I think that's where my instinctual reaction is, yeah.
But I think it's a really cool question, Joe, and I want to talk about it because I might come to a different conclusion.
Well, I guess we start with the elves, right? Those who are most bound by the music.
Elves are very bound by the music. Elves were certainly a part of the music because they were part of the third theme that Iluvatar introduced.
Elves and men were both part of the third theme.
Elves and men were both part of the music. So let's keep that in mind, but let's put men on the side for now.
Sure.
But yeah, let's keep that in mind because elves certainly do create beautiful music.
Yeah.
But they don't talk in music the way Tom or the Ents do.
True.
I mean, like Tom talks in music.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about this. Everything he says fits into that trochaic meter that we talked about, that kind of that meter that's associated with the Kalevala. Mm-hmm. Everything he says fits into that. The Ents have a very musical language and a very musical approach to language, and they do frequently speak in song. The elves are capable of writing beautiful music, and they're capable of singing, and they're capable of speaking in song, but they don't do it as much as the Ents and Tom do.
No.
And yet the elves are very much a part of the music. They were part of Iluvatar's plan, more so even than the Ents. The Ents were Yavanna's idea that Iluvatar took up and put into the music, but
right.
And put into the music while the music was being sung. It wasn't an afterthought, like the dwarves were a later addition. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's why I'm inclined to think not just because the elves are very much a part of the music and they're very much bound to the music, as you said, Alan, and they don't always speak in song. And then you've got men who were part of the music but are not bound to it because we have free
will.
But
they also sing. They also sing a lot.
But they also sing, and they do sing a lot. And especially when you look at races like the Rohirrim, who record their history in song, and they tend to sing more than even the Gondorians do. I think I was looking at something recently that pointed out that there's very little Gondorian poetry in Lord of the Rings at all.
Very little. It's mostly prophetic too, right? It's things like the...
Well, like the riddle, you know?
Yeah.
The
riddle. Isildur's Bane riddle.
Right.
Or the bit about the seven stones. There are just a handful of bits, but they tend to be story related, almost, you know, mystery or prophecy type of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Rohirrim sing a lot. And at the same time, it's different with each group of men. Some sing more than others. Like we just talked about, the Rohirrim sing a lot more than the Gondorians. And at the same time, the hobbits who are descended from men don't seem to have any compunction against singing. They sing all the time. They sing about beer. They sing about baths. They sing about whatever they want to sing about, you know, going down the road. So we have a lot of races that sing, even though they're not bound to the music. We also have a race that sings that wasn't even in the music, the dwarves.
They sing. Absolutely do sing. Far Over the Misty Mountains Cold. Yeah.
I don't know that there's a correlation between singing or how one expresses oneself in song and their role in the music or their nature being bound by the music, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that does make sense. And I think that's kind of where I go with it too. And you look at like the Rohirrim versus the Gondorians. I don't think that the fact that the Rohirrim are a more musical society, I don't think that that means that they're closer to the music in any way. I just think that they record their history in song just because that's where they are. They don't, they don't keep written records the way the Gondorians do.
Right, they don't have a written history. They are people of oral tradition.
So I don't think there's a correlation. I think you're right about that. I do think that when we see races and individuals like Tom and the Ents speaking in music the way they do, I do think that is meant to remind us of the music. So
yeah,
I might be trying to have this both ways, Joe, but I do think that that is what Tolkien is doing when these characters speak musically. I just don't know that it's necessarily the case that when a race doesn't speak in music or that they're not as connected to the music. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That just because they're not musical doesn't mean they're not part of the
music. And I don't know that he's saying that they're more closely related to the music or more bound to the music. I think he's just trying to remind us of the music of nature.
That makes sense.
That's my thought. And you know, I welcome thoughts from anybody else listening to this in the future. I think it's a really interesting question.
It's a fascinating question. I agree. Well, Sean, I know we do have a few more folks in the second round. I also want to give Tom a chance to get in the second round as well. So who's up next?
Next up, we've got another question from Bruce.
All right, Bruce, fire away, sir.
Thank you indeed. This last Sunday, which was before Memorial Day, I got my chance to speak with William Fliss. And so my question, I'll be in the sixth Eorid.
Yeah, excellent. Good for you. Yeah.
Thank you. It was a fun time. I only did 2 out of the 3 minutes, but I got to say plenty. How would you again attempt to encourage your many listeners to participate in William Fliss's Tolkien project?
How would we do it?
By telling them to do it.
So I would start by saying right now to anyone listening to this, folks, if you have not yet signed up for the Marquette University J.R.R. Tolkien Fandom Oral History Collection that's being conducted by William Fliss, who's been a guest of the show a couple of times and who was one of our guest speakers at our moot a week and a half ago. If you have not done that, do yourself a favor and do it. Not only does the project need more interviews, there's plenty of room. And I know that Bill Fliss will make more room if he needs to.
Yes, he will.
Till he gets to that magic number of 6,000. But yeah, I mean, there's still plenty of room. It only takes a few minutes.
3 minutes. 3 minutes is all you get.
3 minutes. I mean, if you want to spend 15 minutes kind of like figuring out what you're going to say, great. You're talking like a total of like 30 minutes, maybe 40. You know, to get this thing done.
We'll tell you right now what the questions are he's going to ask you. They're the same questions. When did you first encounter the works of J.R.R. Tolkien? Mm-hmm. Why are you a Tolkien fan? And what has he meant to you? That's it.
That's it. And you got to answer those three questions in 3 minutes. So you can't really ramble on and on.
Go to his website, which we will include in our show notes again. Follow the links to sign up and then do it. Really.
And then do it.
If half our listeners did that, he'd be full up.
It's true. And he's had people from all over the world join him.
All over the world.
But there's still a few places that he hasn't heard from. So just reach out to him. And maybe you're filling some niche that he doesn't have yet. He doesn't have somebody from your area. Please just reach out to him. It doesn't take any effort to sign up. Again, like Alan said, we'll put a link to the show notes. Doesn't take anything to sign up. Doesn't take much to prepare. And it's correct. A lot of fun. And you'll get to tell your story to the world about what Tolkien means to you, why you're a Tolkien fan, and be a part of something big.
It's huge. Do it. Excellent. Sean, well, how many folks do we have left here in the second round? I know you said we only had a handful of questions this time.
We've got two more folks who've raised their hands and then possibly a third.
All right. Fire away. Who do we have next?
Next up is Rob.
Rob. All right. What do you have for us this time?
Okay. My second question is about the most popular place in Middle Earth, which is, of course, Daggerlad. How many battles occurred on Daggerlad, and why was it such a popular partying spot?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like Miami Beach, man. I know that there was, of course, the Battle of Daggerlad at the end of the Second Age, right? Year 3434,
yep.
Got the Last Alliance, and it's taking place on this big open plain. I don't know if we have any other major battles there, but we do have several battles there during the time of the fighting between Gondor and the Easterling armies, the Wainriders.
Right.
So there were going to be several battles there. And then, of course, the Battle of the Morannon took place, you know, at one corner there, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I think certainly if you're talking about the Battle of Daggerlad in the War of the Last Alliance and the Battle of the Morannon, in both of those cases, the reason that was a spot for the battle is because those were both battles and wars against Sauron,
right.
And that's Sauron's front door, you know, his front porch.
Fight on his front porch, right.
Right. So that makes sense.
And in the battles between Gondor and the Wainriders, it was just a geography thing, you know, Gondor's
coming up the road from the south
and the
Easterlings are coming in from the east
across the plains where they're a cavalry based force.
Yeah.
Right. They're Wainriders. And so they've got they're prevented by the mountain ranges of Mordor from coming directly in line to, let's say, Osgiliath. So they're having to come through the plains of Daggerlad before they could go down Ithilien and come across at Osgiliath, or through Daggerlad and go north to the Undeeps and cross the Anduin there. In either case, the fights are going to take place in the Daggerlad, just sort of a force of geography there in that case.
I mean, it is, because of just the directions that the armies are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, it's a plain. too. Right. I mean, there's not that much open plain in Middle Earth. I mean, yeah, I know there is west of the Misty Mountains and in southern Eriador and so forth, but a lot of the places that characters travel through and that story takes place in, there's not a whole lot of plains. There's forests and mountains and all sorts of other things.
I mean, even in that area, what's to the north of the Daggerlad plains there? It's the Dead Marshes. What's south? The Ethel Duath. I mean, you can't, the battle's going to happen where the battle is able to happen.
It's going to happen right there where a pitched battle can happen.
Right.
You know, out on a plain. So yeah, I think it just makes sense geographically because of everything you just described, Alan. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's Sauron's front doorstep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a question for Brett Devereaux. If we ever get him on the show, how good of a battlefield would an open plain like Daggerlad be? I'm sure he could tell us all kinds of cool stuff.
Oh, I'm sure. We'll have to reach out to him for season 7 as we approach the Battle of the Pelennor Fields.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
All right. You said we have at least one more before we can see if there are other hands. Who would that be?
And that one more is Chad.
Chad.
I'm back.
Oh, no.
So this is another easy one for you. It's just another speculation, which everybody likes to hear y'all go through. So obviously, you know, Rivendell obviously became famous during and after the War of the Ring, but then the elves left. And we know that elven places, like the elves themselves, were destined to fade and their beauty and secrets are lost. So with the elves gone and the world of men rising to prominence under an elf friend king such as El-Essar, do you think that after the last elves left, that the world of men would cherish Imladris as a place of high honor and nostalgia, like you know that all of us, all of we would be doing?
That is an interesting question. I would like to think that with the power of Aragorn's line and the relevance that Rivendell has to them, the significance that Rivendell has to them, that the kings of Gondor, the kings of the United Kingdom of Gondor and Arnor, would absolutely see Rivendell as a very special place. I don't know how long that lasts, though. That's the thing. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I think I'm looking at the prologue here.
Yeah.
Because we get a little bit about... I'm actually just going to read from it. How about that?
Sure, please do. Whenever we're in doubt, read the text.
Yeah, so this is from the last paragraph of the Note on the Shire Records, which is at the very beginning of Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
It is probable that Merry Adoc obtained assistance and information from Rivendell, which he visited more than once. There, though Elrond had departed, his sons long remained, together with some of the High Elven folk. It is said that Celeborn went to dwell there after the departure of Galadriel, but there is no record of the day when at last he sought the Grey Havens, and with him went the last living memory of the Elder Days in Middle-earth.
Oh, that part makes me so sad, the last living memory of the Elder Days.
Yes, especially because I know Arthur, who's listening right now as we're recording this, his theory is that that means that Celeborn made a ship out of Treebeard. So,
which
I love.
Disturbingly possible, yeah. It's kind of like that moment in The Hitchhiker's Guide, a restaurant at the end of the universe, and the cow is trying to talk Arthur into ordering a steak, you know?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
I can see Treebeard now.
I'm done, so you can just make a boat out of me. This wood over here is especially useful for that.
Yeah, exactly.
No.
Terrifying.
It's terrifying. I was thinking of the line in the appendix, the tale of Aragorn and Arwen. And I think even before he dies, Rivendell is already abandoned at that point, isn't it? Doesn't he say something about none now walk in the gardens of Elrond? I'm going to look that up real quick.
I think so. While you're doing that, I'll just kind of talk about what we can conjecture from the prologue, which is that, yes, Rivendell remained a place of learning after Elrond left. His sons were there, at least for a certain amount of time. Some of the High Elves were there. So it was definitely, it remained a place of lore and learning. And certainly Merry, probably other hobbits of the Shire who wanted to learn things, were going to Rivendell. So I do think it probably experienced a kind of a renaissance. And that probably has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, the king in Gondor actually grew up there.
Right.
So
absolutely.
I think that works.
Yeah.
I think the question is, how long does that last? And I do think that Celeborn's departure Well, it's the last living memory of the Elder Days in Middle-earth.
Of the Elder Days.
But that doesn't mean the last living memory, too. So that doesn't mean that the books and the lore and the interest in the lore are
gone. Well, and it doesn't mean that nobody's there. But nobody is there by 4th Age 120 when Aragorn dies. He's
right
on his deathbed, says to Arwen that the hour is indeed hard, yet it was made even in that day when we met under the white birches in the Garden of Elrond where none now walk.
Yeah. So there you go. So yeah,
even 120 years later, it's an empty place.
Now, however,
does that mean it's not honored or revered? I'm
right,
sure it is.
Exactly. It could be.
It's not turned into a tourist trap.
It could be as honored and revered as the Library of Alexandria and not even have to get burned down. But I think that the way to honor it would be to preserve that knowledge. So if Rivendell's abandoned, maybe the texts are brought to Gondor, or maybe some of them are brought to the Shire. And so people do keep that memory alive.
Yeah.
I think it has to be honored for a certain amount of time because, I mean, that's part of that ennoblement that Tolkien is talking
about.
It
is. And Aragorn's line would know that they came from there. There would be an importance placed on that, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Oh, that's where the king grew up. Sure.
We know that Lothlorien was also abandoned by that point, right? Because, we know Celeborn had left because he went to Rivendell first and then he left. But we also know that from that same passage in the appendix. It says about Arwen that after Aragorn had died, spring had not yet come. She laid herself to rest upon Cairn Amroth. But in the passage right before that, we read that Galadriel had passed away and Celeborn also was gone and the land was silent. Nobody was there.
Mm.
So nobody was in Lothlorien and nobody was in Rivendell just 120 years later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think that they would have been honored places, revered places. And for people who were not educated, they would have been terrifying places, right?
Well, that's
but
true.
For the average layperson, oh man, scary, right?
I mean, Lothlorien was scary enough for the
average person
when there was life there.
Right.
Imagine it when it's abandoned.
Oh man, terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
It's the template for every haunted forest in stories later on, you know?
Yeah. Chad, we'll go ahead and do one quick follow-up. Go ahead.
All I was going to say was that for the uneducated being terrified of it, I would like to think that with this new regime that has come in and they're friendly to everyone, that they would have tried to dispel some of those false rumors about these elves being evil. You know?
Oh, certainly. But it would take time for that to pass through. I think it would take generations, perhaps, especially in some of the areas that weren't dominated by the men of Gondor. It would take time. But yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think that they would have worked very hard on education and on, you know, dispelling those myths. Yeah.
I have to think so. Yeah.
All right. Sean, I think we have time for one more. Who do we have?
I think so. And our last question of the evening is going to be Tom.
Tom.
All righty. Now, this is going to revisit a question I asked you guys years ago. And you got the wrong answer then. I'm going to give you another chance. Now, I'm going to come at it a different way.
Okay.
In the Silmarillion, in Of Feanor and the Unchaining of Melkor, it says, before the gates of Valmar, Melkor abased himself at the feet of Manwë and sued for pardon, vowing that if he might be made only the least of the three people of Valinor, he would aid the Valar in all their works, etc., etc.
Right.
Now, the question I asked you years ago was, why do they even have a word for thrall in Valinor? Because you're not going to have a word for something you don't have. So there has to have been some kind of word for property or something like that.
Yeah.
And then I'm just noticing here, why is Melkor talking about free? There's no need to say free unless there are unfree.
Wow.
That's a very good point.
I don't remember this question, Tom.
I don't either. But I'm sure we would have gotten it wrong.
We would have gotten it wrong for sure. Probably why I don't remember it, because, wow, what a question. Why does a society that has no thralls, has no slaves, have a word for thrall? Now,
keeping in mind this is a translation, though.
Keeping in mind that this is a translation, and yes, you can talk about how this was a mannish translation of elven texts that were passed down, but still, it had to be translating something.
Well, I think maybe, Tom, you gave us a little bit of a hint in your question. You said the idea of perhaps property. I'm thinking a word like chattel, which does mean possession, but can also mean, and also was used to mean, slaves. It can mean any number of possessions along those lines. So maybe if you had a word that was the Valinor equivalent of that, a thing that was yours, your possession, then in that context, when that word is used and then translated into Westron, then the Westron eventually translated into English, gets translated as thrall. That is a person that is a chattel, a person that is a possession.
Even if thrall is just a translation of something like chattel, why is that word even applied to people? How does someone even come up with the concept of people being property if there's nobody who's actually property?
Well, because the translator is later.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about the translation of thrall. I'm talking about the original Elvish word that means chattel that was used in that actual dialogue. Why would they even have that concept?
Well, because the idea of a thing.
Yeah.
If I had said your possession, and then I said you were possessions of the Valar, you're like, oh, I only thought you could possess things, but now I see what you mean. You can possess people? Oh, I didn't even think about that. Well, then the later translator would just translate that from possession into...
Because now they have a word that means something slightly different than just
right.
Chattel.
Now we see what he was trying to say. He was trying to say they were his servants or his thralls. That's the only thing I can think of. There's also the other meaning of the word thrall, right? The state of being, you know, having somebody have power over you, you're in thrall to somebody.
Yeah, but I'd bet anything that that's a later metaphorical meaning.
But I think that probably almost certainly is. Yeah.
I could look that up in the OED, but I'm pretty sure that that's the original meaning of that was slave, and it was very literal in Old English.
It was slave. It comes from Old Norse. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Old Norse. The other possibility, maybe this is the answer I gave before, is that those who dwell in Valinor know about thralls because Melkor has thralls. And so there has to be a word for the way Melkor treats his people. Right.
Mm, that's true.
So
that works.
They only know about it from Melkor. Now, why does Melkor then say, if I could be but the lowest of the free peoples of Valinor? Well, because people in Valinor are free. And if I could be just the lowest of them, I would be happy.
I mean, certainly he's been in prison, so he knows free and not free.
Mm-hmm.
And they all know he was in prison and that he wasn't free. So the freedom part, I think we can dispense with that. But the thrall one is a little trickier, isn't it?
Yeah, because I can't conclude that there's any thraldom in Valinor, any actual thraldom in Valinor. It's an earthly paradise, and if somebody's a thrall, it ain't paradise for them.
Right. It's not paradise for them, is it?
Right.
But you're right. They would have had words for Melkor's...
The relationship, and I'm making air quotes, the relationship that Melkor has with those who follow him out of compulsion. They have a word for that.
Yeah, even perhaps the Ainur that had followed him.
That could be.
Right? I mean, there were ones that followed him less out of their own desire and more because they were unable to fight that discord. And so he had enslaved, let's say, the Valar Aukar, for instance. So it's very possible that they did have a word for that.
That's a possibility. It's a step farther than I was going to take it, but it's certainly a possibility. And even if not, I mean, we're still looking at orcs and other creatures that Melkor has in his employ. Air quotes again.
Employ. I love it.
Other people he has on staff, you know.
They're all independent contractors, though. He doesn't want to have to deal with, like, you know, unemployment.
Right. You don't want to have to give him benefits. And
his workman's comp bill is huge.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. That's where I'm landing on it. I think if there is a word for thrall, because they need to describe the hold that Melkor has over his people.
That works for me. Tom does mention in chat, and this is a really interesting insight. He suggests that his idea is that Melkor put that idea in their heads using that word, just like he did with the swords for which they had previously had no need.
That
is insightful.
Wow. Okay.
Because, of course, that is the way Melkor works, right? I mean, he is all about planting these concepts in their heads to stir up strife. And, I like that.
I like that a lot, actually. That Melkor is just going around whispering, you know, you guys are...
You're thralls. Oh, you don't know what that word means? Let me explain what that word means.
You guys are like property of the Valar. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Maybe I don't know if Tolkien ever gave us an Elvish word for thrall.
I don't know.
I do not know that one off the top of my head, sadly.
Have to dig deep into the Parma Elda Lambarons there, I suppose.
Right, exactly. But there could be a word that means, like you said, Alan, means something like chattel or something like property. And Melkor is going around whispering to people like, you know, you guys are basically treated like livestock, you know?
Right. Yeah.
That is a very, very good possibility. And I like that idea, Tom. I can totally get on board with that.
I can totally see that happening. That fits with Melkor in a big way. Yeah.
And Melkor fails to mention, yeah, by the way, that's like all the people who work for me back in Middle Earth. It's like the only way to hire
that's
people.
Right. When people get hired on with me, they sign over everything.
Everything. Yeah.
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 They become my thrall.
My thrall contract.
Those were some great, great questions tonight, weren't they, Sean?
They were. So great. And we got so many of them in. I'm so happy that we managed to get through two full rounds.
That's so rare. That is so rare. So thank you for throwing us not so much easy questions, but questions that could be answered in a relatively short amount of time for the most part. So
yeah,
thanks for helping us put together a really great episode. We appreciate you joining us for Questions After Nightfall, and we hope that you can join us again for the next one. And to everybody listening, we hope that you can join us next week when we pass through the tunnel and gaze at the dark rock of Orthanc and put in our earplugs before Saruman speaks.
Beware of his voice.
Of course.
But in the meantime, don't forget that the conversation continues all night long at the Prancing Pony. Our fantastic listener community keeps the discussion going in all of our social media spaces. At our Common Room on Facebook, you'll find comments, questions, corrections, and more on every episode, as well as updates from us throughout the week. Just look for the Prancing Pony Podcast on Facebook.
And be sure to follow the page and join the group that we've recently created. Now, the page, of course, that's been around since we started. It lets us keep you up to date on the latest happenings, like the moot that just happened recently. But the group gives you a great chance to discuss Tolkien with your fellow listeners and with us.
And of course, we also have some really good discussions going on over on Reddit. You can find us there at r/PrancingPonyPod. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, both with the handle @PrancingPonyPod. And if you're enjoying the show, please share us and please consider giving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Now, this episode airs on July 4th, and our season wraps up in just a few weeks. But if you're paying attention to the episode numbers, well, a little math tells you that episode 222 isn't far away, not at all at all.
No, as a matter of fact, it's going to be either the first or second episode of next season. Now, you might remember the fun we had with our 11D1st episode, going over the highlights of our first 110 shows. Well, we still haven't figured out what to call the 222nd episode, but it is also going to be a highlight show with more selections chosen by you.
That's right. So you should be thinking of your favorite moments from episode 112 through the end of this season and send them in to Barlaman. Be sure to include an episode number, a starting timestamp, but also a brief note describing the segment.
Yeah, that last part's really important because our digital ads actually vary in quantity and in length. So if you just give us a timestamp, we might actually end up off by a minute or two.
Yeah, exactly. Some folks don't even get the ads if you live in a country where our advertiser doesn't work. Some people might get one 30-second ad. Some people might get two. Yeah, so please include that as well.
Yeah. So help us out by identifying what you're talking about clearly. And if we use your selected clip on the show, we'll give you a shout out. And thanks in advance for helping us celebrate our, 11-1 times two.
That works for now. And finally, if you want exclusive content like postscripts, full bonus episodes, live Discord events, or you just want to join the next Questions After Nightfall, check out patreon.com/PrancingPonyPod. Where you can support the show by joining the Fellowship of the Podcast. Well, folks, that does wrap it up for another episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast, but please be sure to join us again next week when we finally hear the voice of Saruman.
How much do you want to bet he sounds like Gilbert Gottfried?
Brilliant. That's exactly who he should sound like.
I think so. We should do the whole episode, all Saruman dialogue like that.
Like Iago?
Exactly. Yeah.
I love it.
It will hurt by the end of the night.
Yeah, that would be painful.
It hurt doing it just now.
Yeah, yeah.
But folks, as always, we want to take a moment to thank some truly important people, our patrons at the Círdan's contribution tier. I'll start with DeMay in Alaska, James in Virginia, Tamsin in Minnesota, Chad in Texas, Lance in New Jersey, Paul in Colorado, Jerry in Texas, Bruce in California, Mario in Utah, Seth in Texas, B in California, Joseph in Texas, and Kathy from North Carolina.
And then we have Lori from Washington, Josh in Oklahoma, Carlos in California, Brian from the UK, Cameron in Nevada, Ned from Connecticut, Jerry from Washington, Nick from Wisconsin, Ryan from Alaska, and Paul from Buckland. Thank you all so much for your support. Of course, we also want to thank the team that helps make our show better. That includes our research assistants, along with our Barlaman, Becca Davis, producer Jordan Runnels, social media manager Casey Hilsey, event and Patreon community coordinator Katie McKenna, and website guru Phil Dean.
The show would not be what it is without our supporters and our teammates, so thank you all so much.
Yeah.
And now be sure you don't miss any episodes of the Prancing Pony Podcast. Subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
And one last thing as always, don't forget to send your thoughts, comments, and most of all, your clarifications of anything we've missed or misstated tonight to Barnum@theprancingponypodcast.com. Please be kind.
Clarification sounds a lot better than the alternative,
doesn't it?
Say.
Yeah, I agree.
And Barlamin is a whole lot more reliable these days.
Oh, yes.
But we do get a lot of mail, so we'll get to you as soon as we can. And your question or comment may be featured on a future episode.
As always, this has been far too short a time to spend among such excellent and admirable listeners. But until next time,
farewell, friends.